For more than 150 years, Marxists have pointed to the preface to a contribution to the Critique of Political Economy as the basis for understanding universal history and as the veritable key to the fundamental contradiction of any mode of production, including capitalism. Let me just read the passage. At a certain stage of development, the material productive forces of society come into conflict with the existing relations of production, or with the property relations within the framework of which they have operated hitherto. From forms of development of the productive forces, these relations turn into their fetters. Then begins an era of social revolution. Here, then, is the foundation for Orthodox Marxism's base superstructure model of social being, its linear philosophy of history with its inevitable stages, and its economic determinism. That understanding of history and sociology would shape the Marxism of the Second International. And despite the enormous political break that had been made, it would shape the theoretical bases of the Third International as well, and frankly, the Fourth. It would perhaps reach its apotheosis in the death agony of capitalism and the tasks of the Fourth International in 1938, when Trotsky proclaimed, quote, "Mankind's productive forces stagnate," end quote. In the more than 70 years since Trotsky penned those lines, the material productive forces, the gigantism of technology, has massively increased on a global scale. Even as capitalism and its value form has extended its grip over the economic, the political, and the social life of humankind. Indeed, the grip of the value form of capitalist social relations of production, in tandem with the unprecedented growth of the material productive forces, today portends unprecedented modes of social decay and barbarism, a world that can be described as a planet of slums, in the chilling words of Mike Davis. It's the contention of this paper that Davis's vision of a planet of slums, in which an ever-increasing mass of the world's population will live in an urban nightmare world of, quote, squalor surrounded by pollution, excrement, and decay, as a description of the world of capitalism south, must be extended to the advanced industrial heartlands of capitalism, in which the working class will confront not episodic, but structural unemployment and a declining standard of living threatening the social reproduction of the collective worker there, too. It's not just in the urban South that this planet of slums is our future. It's right here in New York, in Chicago, in L.A., in London, in Paris. Its form may be different. It's not a question of saying New York will have its favelas and shanty towns in a few years the way Rio does, but in both cases, it is the inability of capitalism to usefully exploit, to valorize the labor power of increasing masses of human beings that leads to this kind of situation. It's not the inability to develop the material productive forces. Those are developing at a rapid rate and have over the 70 years since Trotsky said mankind's productive forces stagnate. It's the inability to valorize labor power, to reproduce the collective worker, that leads to this planet of slums. Now, what's missing from Davis's description of a planet of slums, or in Orthodox Marxist analyses of the immiseration of the working class in the present epoch, is an understanding of the theoretical link between the development of the productive forces, unprecedented scientific and technological development, and that planet of slums, that immiseration. And I want to point to a really great article in Endnotes 2, to which Aaron here contributed, Misery and Debt, which is really an earth-shaking piece of writing on just this question. I'm not going to claim that I took everything from it, because I didn't, but I would urge everyone to read it. It really is an important text. What's missing in the theoretical arsenal of traditional Marxism is precisely the possibility of a disjunction between the creation of real wealth and the creation of value, which Marx first explicated in the Grundrisse, and which characterizes the present age of capitalism. Whereas for a whole historical epoch, the value form provided a basis for the enormous increase in material or real wealth, despite the horrors of primitive accumulation and the Industrial Revolution, despite the satanic mills that William Blake pointed to. The present epoch is characterized by a creation of value and a development of the productive forces at the expense of the real wealth of humankind. And while orthodox Marxism has been theoretically blind to the underlying basis for that contradiction between the production of value and the creation of real wealth, in my view, Marx was not blind to that. Now, there's a bit of an excursus here. In a sense, it's really only in the past 60 years that we have really had access to Marx's own efforts to grasp the historical specificity of capitalism and the imminent tendencies and contradictions of the value form. I mean, until the mid-20th century, basically, we read Volume 1 of Kapital, as Marx had published it, but we never read the first volume of Kapital in its first edition, the 1867 edition. There's that great story that Hans Georg Backhaus tells about inadvertently coming upon a copy of the first edition of Kapital, and the fact that it was an eye-opening experience for him, because whereas the second edition has been popularized by Marx, I admit, yes, but it's a popularization in several critical points. The first edition is not a popularization, and it makes no apologies for the rigor of understanding the value form. As far as volume 3 of Kapital is concerned, many of you probably know that now the Mega edition has published the actual manuscript of volume 3. There are hopes Fred Moseley is trying to translate it into English. It's a different book than the volume that Engels published. It's not a point of making, I'm not trying to make the point that Engels deliberately subverted Marx's thinking, but Engels' thinking was not the same as Marx's, and there is a real difference between the manuscript of volume 3 and the published volume. As far as the Grundrisse was concerned, as far as the famous results of the immediate process of production, these didn't see the light of day until the 1960s. And the whole of the 1861-1863 manuscript, which is now available in the collected works in English translation, the only thing we saw of that until the 1960s was what Karl Kautsky published, cobbled together out of the original manuscript. In other words, in a certain sense, we're only beginning to read Marx for the first time now. And there are differences, including, I would argue, a real explication of how capitalism can no longer develop the material or real wealth of humankind, even as value continues to expand, and even as science, technology, and the material productive forces not only continue to grow, but in a sense grow exponentially, at a far faster rate than in any other point in human history. And I would further argue that these manuscripts of Marx are preeminently political, and the political implications need to be mined if we're serious about putting an end to capitalism. Now, let me get into the guts or heart of how capitalism can continue to develop the material productive forces, not only can, but must. David Harvey has grasped some of the complex threads that compel capitalism to develop the material productive forces, a compulsion that is not transhistorical, as in the preface, but is historically specific to a civilization based on the value form. He says in The Limits of Capital, capitalism is necessarily technologically dynamic. It exists under the imperative, innovate or perish, end quote. That imperative arises from the ceaseless drive to extract surplus value from living labor, a drive that impels capital to increasingly rely on the extraction of relative surplus value. As, quote this again from The Limits of Capital, relative surplus value as the prime lever for furthering the accumulation of capital through perpetual increases in the value productivity of labor power, end quote. For each capital entity, whether it's a state, an enterprise, However, competition impels capitalism towards perpetual revolutions in the productive forces. That last was also a quote from Harvey. I have many problems with David Harvey and with the limits of capital, but I think he's spot on in that respect. That compulsion derives from the ability of capitals with better, more efficient technology, with a higher organic composition of capital, to extract both more surplus value from living labor and to obtain a surplus profit on the world market, to effect a transfer of profit from the capital entities with a low organic composition to capital entities with a high organic composition. As Marx says in Volume 3 of Capital, yes, this is the published version, there is, quote, a surplus profit for those producing under the best conditions in any particular sphere of production, end quote, where best conditions means most technologically advanced. In his 1861-63 manuscripts, Marx showed that because the value of commodity is determined by the socially necessary labor time, the average labor time it takes to produce it, quote, with the introduction of new machinery, and as long as the major part of production continues to be based on the old means of production, the capitalist can sell his commodity at less than its social value, even though he sells it at more than its individual value, i.e. for more labor time than he requires to manufacture it under the new production process. Now, simply put, what Marx was saying in that manuscript was those capitals that have a high organic composition of capital, that are technologically advanced, get a surplus profit, an excess profit, an extra Mehrwert, extra surplus value, because they are producing below the socially necessary average labor time and can sell the product at a price higher than the socially average, than the socially necessary labor it takes to produce it, thereby accumulating an extra profit, a surplus profit. That is the key to why the most industrial advanced countries continue to rake in the lion's share of surplus value. And I would argue this against all those who say that, no, it's the BRICS that are the future of the world. I heartily doubt that. I think it misunderstands what's happening in the real world, and it misunderstands what Marx was saying would happen in the real world, and it misunderstands the logical unfolding of the basic categories of the value form. So here, then, is the source of that surplus profit obtained by capital with a high organic composition. The worker gives the capitalist, and this is a quote from that same 1861-63 manuscript, the worker gives the capitalist a greater number of hours of labor as surplus labor, and it is only this relative surplus labor which provides the latter, the capitalist, when selling the commodity, with the excess of its price over its value. End quote. The capitalist accumulation process in the present epoch hinges on this. The effect of this dynamic is the creation of a vast population with only its labor power to sell, dispossessed of any means of production, and yet of no use to capital. This population, whether in the capitalist South or in the once industrial heartlands of the capitalist North, is not the traditional industrial reserve army, which has long served to put downward pressure on the wages of the collective worker and to be integrated back into the labor process when bust turns into boom, which is certainly how the Second International and even the Third International understood the industrial reserve army. The ceaseless quest for relative surplus value on the part of capital, for the surplus profits that technological advances provide for a given capital entity, and that drives forward the development of the material productive forces, produces an exponentially rising mass of workers for whom capital has no use, but which must be controlled. For Marx, the accumulation process, and here I'll cite Volume 1 of Capital, the second edition, for Marx, the accumulation process becomes, in turn, a source of new changes in the composition of capital, or in other words, of an accelerated diminution of the capital's variable component as compared with its constant one, end quote. It is then capitalist accumulation, this is a quote from Volume 1, that constantly produces and produces indeed in direct relation with its own energy and extent a relatively redundant working population, i.e. a population which is superfluous to capitalism's requirements for its own valorization and is therefore a surplus population, end quote. And in the same chapter of Volume 1, Marx says, this is the absolute general law of capitalist accumulation, end quote. Today, we can see all around us this mass of workers, whether we go to Rio, whether we go to Cairo, whether we go to China, whether we go to India. They're not in Bangalore, but they are all over India, in the shanty towns of Mumbai. We can see it in the United States, we can see it in France and all over Western Europe. It is the fate to which capitalism and the value form condemns humankind, and there is no way within capitalism and the value form to extricate itself from that fate. Now, that fate is not written from the beginning of history. It is historically specific to capitalism. It is a price we are paying for the fact that the proletarian revolutions of 1917 failed, that counter-revolution took place, that capitalism is still in power all over the world, nowhere stronger than in Beijing. But it is nonetheless the fate with which we live in this epoch until or unless we can overthrow and abolish the value form. Today we can see all around us this mass of workers, that segment of the collective worker whose very existence is not even a potential source of surplus value for capital, but is absolutely redundant. And in Capital, Marx says, quote, the mass of a consolidated surplus population. That is what Hu Jintao, for the next few months, will have to grapple with, and whoever succeeds him. That is what Barack Obama will have to grapple with. That is what David Cameron is grappling with, and Angela Merkel, and Sarkozy, and Papandreou, and the Greek socialists. In every country of the world, capital is grappling with this redundant, this consolidated surplus population. Whether or not that consolidated surplus population can develop the consciousness to overthrow the value form, or whether it can be controlled by capital, really is the basic fundamental question of this era. Now, I just want to conclude. How much time do I have? Unlimited, right? No, I'll be quick. So, how then can capital attempt to maintain its control over the collective worker, an ever-increasing part of which is condemned to penury so long as the value form exists? With respect to the shanty towns and favelas that are growing exponentially in the increasingly urban South, Mike Davis, in his chapter, A Surplus Population, can point us in the right direction. I don't think Davis grasps the significance of what he said, and I don't think his politics leads to grasping it, but this is what he said on page 185 of Planet of Slums. Social desperation or even revolt, quote, is usually transmuted into ethno-religious or racial violence, end quote. There is no better example of this than Mumbai, the real contrast to Bangalore, with a far greater population and growing at a huge rate every year. I don't mean the Mumbai of the tourists and the hotels, although even there terrorist attacks can occur. I mean the Mumbai of the neighborhoods. It is a city of apartheid. It is a segregated city. There are Muslim neighborhoods. There are Hindu neighborhoods. There are neighborhoods in which people speak Maharashtri and people speak Hindi. And don't cross that line and go into the wrong neighborhood. You will be dead. There are gangs, the Shiv Sena, the biggest Hindu gang, runs its neighborhood. Muslim gangs run their neighborhood. It's the Bloods and the Crips, writ large. And their primary function, and I'm not a functionalist, but what they do is keep order for capitalism and rake in the profits. And this is true in every favela, in every slum. The names of the groups are different, the names of the gangs are different, but the reality is the same. It can be narco traffickers in Mexico, it can be the Shiv Sena and its fascism in Mumbai, but this is the phenomenon in the urban south. But it's also the phenomenon and will be increasingly in the urban north. Mike Davis, in his book Dead Cities, has an interesting chapter on Compton. If you've ever been to Compton, and it's not that I recommend it for tourism, but he has an excellent chapter, Fear and Loathing in Compton. And it's indicative of the potential ensconced within the ethnic and racial fault lines that characterize the urban landscape of the most industrialized countries in the world. I mean, he says there is an invisible line. On one side of the line, it's the Bloods. On the other side of the line, it's the Crips. There's another line, equally invisible. On one side, it's the Latinos. On the other side, it's the African Americans. Don't cross that line if you're in the wrong place, because it will be your end. And these gangs, in some cases, gangs of politicians, I mean, there is a family, an African American family that dominates Compton, has dominated it since it became a predominantly African American city over 25, 30 years ago. And they rake in the profits because all of that money that is fed to them, largely by the Democratic Party, of course, they are a part of it, is to keep order in Compton. Not to keep order so that workers will work for low wages. There are no low-wage jobs in Compton. There haven't been for 30 or 40 years. All there is a redundant population, a surplus population that has to be kept from spilling over into those neighboring towns where there are factories and there are industrial workers or service workers. And that is the job that these gangs, these rackets, to quote Gilles Dauvay, fulfill in capitalism in the present epoch. And given the existence of this increasingly redundant population, well, I mean, look at the austerity that is a wave breaking over Western Europe, and which will probably soon break over the United States, more quickly if Barack Obama is reelected president, in my opinion, than if he's not. But it's what awaits us. What's happening? Sovereign debt crises, a need to slim down the working class, both in terms of wages and in terms of numbers. I mean, look at the most fantastic job that the Obama administration has done for the American automobile industry, now profitable again, and to be sold off to Wall Street again. I mean, General Motors has had its most profitable few months in decades. Now, part of it is because it's the biggest automaker in China. Okay, China is capitalist. Why shouldn't GM dominate the auto market in China? But it's also because the Obama administration, through its semi-nationalization of GM, through the bailout, and it's not just GM, it's Ford and it's Chrysler too, have renegotiated all the contracts to create a two-tier system in which new workers will get paid a fraction of what old workers got paid, in which even old workers have watched their pensions disappear, their wages be lowered. This is an accomplishment that I doubt that George W. Bush could ever, in his fondest dreams, have brought about. I mean, look at the Obama cabinet. Bill Daley, J.P. Morgan Chase, is his key advisor. You have Tim Geithner, who has a dominant role in the cabinet. And then look at the war cabinet. General Petraeus, is it only 2 years ago that he was called by people on the left General Butraeus? No, now he will be the CIA chief. And of course, who goes over to defense? Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, who knows how to carry an operation where the aim is to execute and kill. We can't waterboard prisoners in Gitmo, but we can shoot through the eyes someone without taking them a prisoner on the direct orders of the President of the United States. And who elected Barack Obama? I don't want to say it's people sitting in this room because I don't want to embarrass anyone, but I want to say that if it wasn't the left, then I don't know who it was. Yes, I know, it was the lesser of two evils, we were told. But as someone once said, yes, the Democrats are the lesser of two evils, but it's only half right. The Democrats are evil. I'll end at that.